The human being is a curious creature, an asker, a wanderer, curious about everything from the sand under his soles up and out to the stars and beyond the stars, asking, how did it all happen? Wondering, where will it end? For thousands of years, imagination was the only answerer to our questions. So, for thousands of years, bright old men and wise old women told and retold the stories of how life began, what it means, and what our place is in the midst of it all. One of the many such stories is the one that was born in the oases of the Near East, told around the campfires of the desert, and finally incorporated into the little books, or Bible, of our Judeo-Christian heritage. It is an old, old story of how the mountain god of the Hebrews, Yahweh, spoke light into darkness and said life into being, and finally molded the human form out of the clay of the earth and breathed it into living. Even today, that story is a beautiful poem, and that myth is a precious part of our literature. But for thousands of years, it was the actual and only answer that the Western mind could find. But a century ago, with the development of modern science and the scientific method of investigation, a new answer was developed by, among others, Charles Darwin. It is an answer called the theory of evolution, which says, briefly, that life forms emerge from previous, simpler life forms. It says that the human being is part of nature and not apart from nature. It says that the human organism was derived from the same or similar forces and processes as were the mosses and the mealworms. It claims that we had our roots in the same ancestors as did the gibbons and the chimpanzees. To the religiously rigid, this was frightening. To the dogmatic, this was heresy. To the theologically frozen, this was blasphemy. But to the liberal religious mind and the scientific mind, evolution was not only a new, but a better answer. Try as they could, the biblical literalists could not stem the tide of the modern mind, and debate between creationists and evolutionists seemed essentially settled once and for all when Clarence Darrow made a monkey out of William Jennings Bryan in the Scopes trial of 1925. But the fundamentalist creationists stuck by their guns, muzzleloaders, of course, and bided their time, which the rest of us thought would never come again. But it has. With a present swing to the religious right wing, creationism has become one of the significant issues of our time. With a growth in numbers of converts to old-time religion, creationists are demanding a repudiation of the theory of evolution, despite its overwhelming scientific evidence. They are asking for equal time in the science classes of schools. They are bringing lawsuits into courts and bills before legislatures, and are successfully influencing parents, teachers, and school boards with arguments and powers we haven't seen from them in 50 years. With a new confidence, they are claiming that creationism is both better religion and better science than evolution. This new old controversy between creationism and the theory of evolution is really a power struggle between modern science and biblical religion, between empiricism and emotionalism, data and dogma, the questing mind and the unquestioning mind. It is a contest to determine which shall have the power of authority, not over the private minds of individuals, but over the public institutions of society. The question is not, are people free to reject scientific conclusions and even to believe what is rationally improbable, impossible, or imbecilic? But where shall formal legal educational authority reside? Whatever else it is a political problem, and is, in my estimation, born again out of our darker ages, to the unholy wedlock of scientific ignorance and the frightened faith of fanatical fundamentalism. And I do not hesitate to say that the consummation of that marriage is devoutly to be unwished. The conception is not immaculate, and the birth promises to be traumatic for everyone except those who have seen the light, a light that is too often cast by the burning of books. But there is another dimension to this debate, the religious dimension. Because the creationist has created this controversy, the debate tends to be set up according to his or her definitions and in his or her vocabulary. Because they have taken the initiative, we are apt to be put on the defensive. Consequently, there is a dangerous tendency for us to get trapped in the narrow confines of his mind. For example, because she says the creation story in the book of Genesis is literally true, you and I may be tempted in the heat of debate to react negatively and dismiss the book of Genesis as useless, throwing the poetic baby out with the unscientific bathwater. Or if he says, God did it, I may be prompted to say simply, didn't. Instead of saying the question is not God, but how. The argumentative temptation is to fall into the thoughtless practice of saying, as the old song said, if you say potato, then I say potato. And if you say tomato, then I say tomato. When we should, as the song says, just call the whole thing off. You and I should not get caught in a simple reactionism of those who think that the only true faith is the one that can be compressed between the pages of the book like a corsage from some prehistoric prom. Instead, we should realize that the debate is between theologies, religions, and faiths, and is not, as the fundamentalist imagines, between theism and atheism, between religion and irreligion, or between faith and faithlessness. So, this new old controversy is not only the question which is better science, creationism or evolution, but which is better religion, or more correctly, which provides the more valid basis for religious response and belief. Unlike one of the current debates between scientists about evolution, in which classical Darwinians say that new species evolve out of existing ones by a gradual accumulation of small changes, and the newer belief that species change little for long periods and then evolve quickly in a kind of quantum leap, a debate that in no way questions the principles of evolution, and a debate that will be resolved by the gradual collection and interpretation of viable data. Unlike that debate, the debate between two schools of theology is insoluble on any provable basis. Instead, it is resolved for individuals on the basis of their knowledge and what seems reasonable and acceptable to them. The proof of the pudding of religion is in its highly personal eating, not in a chemical analysis of its ingredients. My theology, like any other, is characterized by my perception of that which I conclude is greater than myself alone, by my experience of wonder and reverence, and by what I imagine is the object of that wonder and that reverence. The shape of my theology is determined by what I conceive to be the source and sustainer of life, its character as I perceive it. and how I perceive my relationship to it in both its transcendent and its immanent ways. I'm referring to that which is called the first cause, the prime mover, the ultimate reality, the ground of being, the creator, the divine, in short, God. Every religion's theology has this same character. What differentiates theologies, yours from mine and ours from others, is not whether we perceive God by whatever name, but how we perceive it and what we imagine its character and function and relationship to us to be. And that is why the question, "Do you believe in God?" is really a meaningless question. That is why the fundamentalists charge that evolution is atheistic is absurd. So, fundamentalism and religious liberalism, the theology of Billy Graham and the theology of Albert Einstein, are vastly different, not because one is theological and the other is not, but because of the perceived realities to which each responds and the different definitions of the nature, function, and purpose of those realities, as well as the believer's felt relationship to those realities. I contend that the creation stories of the Bible, which are the source of the creationist's response, are charming stories and valuable pieces of historic literature, but are inadequate grounds upon which to build a modern philosophy of life and to formulate a personal religious response that can hold up its head in the company of modern minds. The reason I say this is that, however unfinished the theory of evolution is, it implies a saga of fabulous dimensions that stretch out in time and space farther and more wonderfully than does the once wondrous firmament on which old Israel's God hung the sun and moon and stars. Its theories far overshadow the dusty potterings of the old biblical God with an implication of divinity, whose miracles are as microscopically amazing as the double helix, and so distant as to outdistance the imagination. The theory of evolution speaks of probable processes that leave the creative voice of Yahweh mute and make his six-day labor but a blink in the long gaze of creation. It speaks not of a once and only once miracle by a God who had to rest when it was done, but of a continuation and a continuity of which even we are an intrinsic part and product. In intricacy, complexity, and magnitude, the unfinished story of evolution sings through the marveling mind like an endless oratorio, rising from the smallest grace notes of the proteins of life's beginnings to a crescendo as overwhelming as the cosmos. It says to me that the music of the spheres is a far greater work than that simple song once sung around the desert nomads' campfires. And to me, it says that anything else is heresy. Anything else is blasphemy. It implies, as creationists cannot, that we are not the refugees from a fallen paradise or an evil nature, but that we are interdependent children, firmly held in the family of life and bound in biological fealty to life in all its manifestations from here to eternity. And as such, it says to me that we should eat our breakfast eggs as though they were the sacred elements in a Eucharist. Welcome flocks of sparrows as flights of angels, and walk our minds barefoot on the common soil, speechless with the knowledge that it is holy ground. As such, we should kill even the lowliest only out of absolute necessity, and then in reverent grief. And we should daily adore the carrot and the beef as ones who have died for us that we might have life. As such, we should kneel in the garden in awe, scoop up and hold its soil as though it were the flesh of God, and drop the seeds as if we were annunciating angels participating in the conceptions of holy births. As such, every act of conspicuous consumption, pollution, waste, and overpopulation, and every endangerment of every species should be seen as sin. This is, of course, not science. These words are implications drawn from the theory of evolution as I see it and as I respond to it. This is not science, but a poetic and theological response to scientific thought. It is the example of one man's leap of faith, one person's mind that can neither reject the best that our science has to offer nor ignore the religious impulse. It is a leap of faith that, unlike that of the creationist, leaps ahead from the questionable truth and simplistic security of the pre-scientific past. And I would say to the creationist what Hamlet said to Horatio: there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. A philosophy of religion appropriate for our times and minds must account for and respond to the things we know and suspect exist in our heaven and our earth more than our ancestors could ever have dreamt of.